Okay, guys, first things first. I'm not sure what they have in store for you, if anything, but I'm not going to be here Wednesday or Monday. I'm going to Israel for a few days. I'm going to visit my son in Yeshiva. Since it is my wife's nephew's bar mitzvah on Shabbos, the in-laws are paying for the trip. That's pretty good, right?
Very cool.
Perfect timing.
For how many people?
Just one. Not even for their daughter, only for me. So I'll see you again after tonight, next Wednesday, Mr. Shem. Tonight is Jewish History Night, and we have arrived at the Maharal.
Oh.
And the Maharal is very focal to also both our Monday night shiur, which is history, and our Wednesday night shiur, which is Agadah, because the Maharal is the man. He's the one who actually introduced Klal Yisrael on a broad scope to how to approach Chazal, how to understand what goes on in the Gemara. Now, I don't know that much about my history in the Maharal. There's a good book. I don't know if you've seen this book ever. It's called The Maharal of Prague. And, what? He didn't begin in Prague. It's where he began somewhere else. I forget where he was born. Poland. Okay.
That's South Poland?
Yeah, South Poland. But it went back and forth between Germany and Poland.
Now Galicia, right?
No. I think it's Moravia.
Oh. Czech Republic.
Yeah. The Czech Republic. Right. So, the Maharal was I don't see if it has the exact date here when he was born, but it was in...
The father of the Golan?
It was in the early 1500s.
When? When he was the father, who was the mother?
What?
When was that?
He was born in the early 1500s, and he died in the early 1600s. So he died pretty old, around the age of 80, I think, about 1604, 1605. So in any event, I've said this many times before, but I'm going to say it again. I'm going to read you a little bit about it. The Golem never existed. Okay?
Uh-huh. Oh. So that room that they have in the synagogue in Prague,
all baloney. All baloney. I'm going to read you what I say in the book. This is a very nice book. Okay?
Wait, he said straight out the Golem didn't exist?
No, he doesn't say straight out. He can't say that straight out. I'm saying it straight out. Is it possible that the Maharal created a Golem? For one who believes in the incredible abilities of our holiest rabbis, the answer must be that it is certainly possible. The rabbis of the Talmud are said to have engaged in such practices. In more recent days, the Chaim Bavalogin, prime student of the Vilna Gaon and a very sober observer, testifies that the Vilna Gaon himself said he had begun to construct a golem in his youth, but feeling that it was not the wish of Hashem, ceased the project. Did the Maharal construct a golem? There's much about the Maharal that remains hidden and unknown. Therefore, this is not a fair question to ask. One can ask, rather, are the stories told about the Maharal's creation, use of a golem, reliable? He doesn't say no, but that's the short answer. He says, the first chronicler of the life of Maharal was a student, Rabbi David Ganz. In none of his writings does Rabbi Ganz make a mention of a golem. The next chronicler is Rabbi Meir Perlis, a descendant of Maharal, who in the early 18th century wrote Megillat Yehayuchtin. Although he tells a good number of tales about the Maharal, he too makes no mention of a golem. The first known mention of a golem made by the Maharal is in Sipurim stories. A collection of tales by L, I guess you don't know the first name, Wiesel, printed in Prague in 1847. Okay, so that's 240 years or so after the Maharal passed away. In his introduction, Wiesel says he is retelling folk tales that he heard old people tell. He tells the story of the Maharal creating a golem to help him in his housework. See, I guess good help was hard to get in the old days. It seems hard to credit that the pious Maharal would make use of godly power simply to create a labor-saving device. Then in 1909, the collection of tales entitled Mithlosa Maharal was published. Only now for the first time appears link between the golem and blood libel. Only now for the first time appear all the tales of Thaddeus, the renegade priest, of a palace with haunted secret passageways, and of other details which are so well known. There are several questions that the text raises. First of all, one may wonder why such sensational events escape being recorded before that time. In addition, there are some peculiarities in the text. The manuscript is said to have been to be an authentic diary written by Rabbi Yitzchak Katz, the Maharal's son-in-law. But the place names used are not the Czech names that Rabbi Katz would have used, but rather Slavic names. Names that might have been more familiar to someone else in the Slavic country. But most suspicious, the text contains gross historical inaccuracies. For instance, the Maharal is said to have engaged in his hypothetical debate with Cardinal Sylvester and immediately afterward been admitted to an interview with King Rudolf. This is said to have taken place in the first year of the Maharal coming to Prague in 1572. But Rudolf II did not become king until 1576, and even then he did not establish his primary residence in Prague until 1583. Mithlosa Maharal is said to have been found in the Metz library of Rabbi Chaim Sharfstein and was consulted by Rabbi Udo Rosenberg, who published it. Rabbi Udo Rosenberg was a known forger. He forged lots of stuff. You know, in the old days, it was hard to make a living if you weren't just a rabbi who lived in Montreal. So he actually moonlighted as a forger. So the thing about that, and it seems reasonable to assume that both these men were victims of a clever forgery. I don't believe victims. Late 19th century was the time during which a number of gifted writers, among them literary maskilim, took advantage of the great interest in stories of Hasidic rabbis to create collections of tales out of whole cloth. It goes on in this vein. And then afterwards he does bring down the legends of the Maharal. Of course there is this legend, you know, which has to do with the attic of the shul in Prague. Obviously over time that became a nice story to tell, and probably nobody went to the attic anyway, so it became a popular myth that the golem was up there.
I thought someone said in a newspaper article that they saw like about that Nazi soldiers that wanted to go up there and they got up there and died. I thought like it was actually like a newspaper someone said.
If that was actually a newspaper article which was published, don't you think more of us would know about it than the guy who told you that he saw it somewhere or heard it stated?
I mean, it could be a lot of things like that. We just don't know, man. I mean, like, why that really...
But why would the guy who told you know it and not any of the rest of us?
People see things that I wouldn't see. I don't see everything.
Don't you think we would know such a newspaper story would be very much publicized in Jewish community?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, that's unlikely that it's true. As a matter of fact, it's impossible that it's true. So why do these stories come up about the Maharal? Obviously, Rabbi Rosenberg, or whoever made up these stories, picked the Maharal for this purpose because the Maharal was the person who would be most believable would build a golem. By the way, there are shaylos in halacha about a golem. For example, there is the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi was one of the great poskim of the late 7th. What? No, that's the Abnei Neger. The Chacham Tzvi was in the late 17th, early 18th century, and he had the shiloh whether you can use a golem to make a minion. If you have nine and a golem, does it make a minion or not? What?
I thought that was a golem.
No, it does not speak about it. Whether you can use it for a minion. So,
what did he say?
I think he says no. So there are certainly golems that are taken as a possibility. And Rabbi Ari Kaplan Sefer Yetzirah, he gives detailed instructions as to how to make a golem. As I mentioned here many times in the past, it takes 7 hours straight concentration uninterrupted. So after we can stop, we'll start concentrating for about 30 seconds uninterrupted, maybe we can start working up towards the 7 hours. What?
What? Where did he get that from?
From ancient manuscripts. He published the. Sefer Yetzirah himself doesn't contain the instructions explicitly, but commentaries on Sefer Yetzirah can contain the instructions. Okay?
You said the Gemara talks about Golem also?
Gemara says, you know, the source for the statement abracadabra, right? Who knows where abracadabra comes from? Rava Bara Gavra. Rava Bara Gavra. Rava made a man. That's the Gemara, I forget what it is. Rava Bara Gavra is either source for abracadabra. So obviously they didn't. The Gemara speaks about two Amoraim who were hungry and didn't have what to eat, so they made a goat from Sefer Yetzirah. You know, there are all sorts of various different stories in the Gemara itself about these things taking place.
But is this the same? I heard that when the three people came by to visit Abraham and they served them tongue, Abraham summoned three cows or something.
Right, there's one story like that. There's one, that's why he could give them milk and meat together because it wasn't really meat.
So would it be the same way if you'd see Rome?
What? Yeah, same thing.
And the Gemara talks about making a calf or something, right?
A calf, maybe not a goat, maybe a calf it was, but a calf, yeah. Okay, but what the Maharal really is very most important for, and perhaps next week we'll come back to more of that history because I didn't have time to bone up too much on his life story tonight. Okay. A lot more fun out there than it is in here. So what the Maharal did is he wrote a systematic commentary and many others for him on the topic of understanding Chazal according to very profound systems of thought. Now, Zari, who was preceded the Maharal by several years, although their lives overlapped, made Kabbalah very widespread. And we spoke about him for the past couple of weeks. But he didn't peg his Kabbalah, or didn't connect his Kabbalah back up with Nigra, with the revealed Torah of Chazal. Kabbalah remained a separate discipline, distinct from Chazal themselves. Moreover, he didn't link it up with philosophy either. Obviously, the Rishonim, many of them are very philosophical, the Rambam being the salient example. So the Arizal himself and his students did not bother reconnecting their system or connecting their system with the philosophical system of the Rishonim. The Maharal brings them all together. Mm-hmm. Everything comes together in Maharal, philosophy and Kabbalah, and also, very important, Musar. In other words, the Maharal held that one has to focus directly on ethical conduct and ethical training. This is very different than Ari, who did not speak about it at all. Not at all, but spoke about it relatively little. But it is similar to the Rambam, who did devote a lot of writing to the development of ethical character. Also, Maharal is famous for his Derech HaLimud. The Maharal hated the way yeshivas learned. The way we learn today, the Maharal would be here, he would have a heart attack. Yeah. He would go ballistic.
Wow.
Right. So he held that people should have to learn a lot and chazer and learn a lot and chazer. None of this, you know, spending, you know, days on the same block, which is very foreign to the Maharal's mentality. Not that anybody ever listened to him either, I assume. But the Maharal held very much of Chazal's description picking up from 5 to 10, learn only Mikra. From 10 to 15, learn Mishnah. At 15, start Gemara. Today, as in the past a few decades, there arose a system of schools, both in Israel and now in Chutz Lareitz, called the Zilberstein schools. Thank you. The Zilberstein schools of this Rabbi Zilberstein, which based on the Mishnah picking up and the Maharal, follow this pattern. Now, I'm not sure. Nobody's sure what the long term holds for the products of these schools. It's interesting that you have these schools both in very Haredi communities and also in very religious Zionist communities. This transcends political definitions, but since they're so different than the rest of the school system, nobody knows what's going to be down the line. Are these great going to create a whole new cadre of great scholars who are no longer, who are way light years beyond everybody else, or is it going to create a cadre of misfits who don't fit in with everybody else? Nobody knows what's going to happen. It'll be interesting to watch. One thing about the Zilberstein method is that there are no days off. Every day, 7 days a week, there's school. Okay?
Oh,
wow. Shabbat.
Yeah.
Yom Tov and
everything.
Yeah. Think about Yom Kippur.
Hey, what's the justification of that?
What?
Well, how's the other
thing to if you want to master Torah, you can. There's no off time.
So it's not regulation?
What? Nothing.
Wow.
Nothing at all.
Okay. Yeah. The idea is that...
it's good for the parents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the idea is that these kids wouldn't know any different, so like they wouldn't think of it as like...
Could all friends
or much.
Well, you know, if you keep them in a vacuum, that might happen, but I'm sure they do hear about schools in which people are off in the summer. No, I think the school, probably the schools, I'd imagine the schools are less pressurized than our schools, because they, until 10, you're learning only Tanakh, right? You're not trying to impress the kids with Gemara, which is beyond their years, right? You're going to wait with Gemara until they master Tanakh, and then they master Mishnayot. And Gemara only comes afterwards.
Who would teach that? That's new. They are awesome.
When you say like that after Tanakh and Mishnah, does that mean like finishing everything?
Yeah.
Or just mastering? Yeah.
No. Everything.
With my portion?
Everything. I don't know, I mean, portion because it's supposed to be, you know, just, by 2 and 5 years of Tanakh, you gotta learn some of portion. Yeah.
Alright, so if they're learning, how long has the Zilberstein been used already?
I don't know. For a couple of decades, probably.
So then we do have the products of the school.
Yeah, I have not made a study of them. I don't know. They're not famous. In other words, there's no great Ewing somewhere who is the product of the Zilberstein method who is, you know, has been identified positively as Metzger or Hador.
How long has the Zilberstein method been put into use so far?
A couple of decades.
So we don't know how...
No, I don't know. Maybe somebody does know.
How do they find teachers who won't ever take a day off?
China.
I wouldn't work there.
Good question. I don't know. I said I wouldn't either. Yeah.
Hey,
regarding
the Golem, I heard like from the 3 people that came sort of story about the Nazis that went up to the sort of attic of the, you know, the Grand Synagogue of Prague.
I heard that too.
All right, so now we're going to Google this. That's it. Okay, we're going to Google this and find out what we'll see what we can find. Anybody else want to volunteer to Google besides me?
I'll be sure.
I'll do it right now.
That's fine. I don't believe it. You know,
what the Golem is not true, most likely.
You know, if that was true, you know, this thing, the reason why I doubt it, another main reason that is, this would be a great Kiruv tool. Mm. So when you went to Kiruv 101, they tell you about the Megillah, the little letters in the Megillah, the Tosk, the Shin, the Zion, right, 1947. Awesome. You all know that, right?
No.
No, you don't know?
I wasn't thinking about the normal.
You didn't take Kiruv 101?
No.
I'm sorry.
No offer. North Dakota.
What?
They
don't offer North Dakota.
So, you have to know this, because otherwise you won't be able to graduate or something else.
Okay.
In Megillah Esther, okay, so in the Megillah, let's see if they have it properly. Yeah, they probably do. Yeah, if you take a look at page 1260, you'll see the 10 sons of Haman.
Yep.
And there are there are 3 little letters in the 10 sons of Haman. Parshandosa has a little Sof, Parmashto has a little Shin, and Vaizosa has a little Zayin. And nobody could have known what those letters signified until 1947. In 1947, which corresponds to the Hebrew year Hey, I love him.
Is it 1947?
47.1947, and in the year 1947, the Nuremberg trials took place. 11 Nazis were slated to be hung. But one of them committed suicide. Who remembers who?
Darren.
Darren committed suicide.
Didn't they say he was like a cross-dresser or something like that?
They say that, but you know, obviously he was not particularly upstanding human being.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
But they would say because he's like the
it's not relevant. Anyway, he committed suicide.
Yeah.
That's important for our story. So they only hung 10 sons of Haman, and as Julius Streicher, who was mounting the gallows. By the way, a couple of those 10 would seem should not have been hung because their crimes were not so terrible, relatively speaking. There was Yodel, who was the assistant chief of staff, and nobody knew exactly where he was hung, but he was hung. We had made up the number 10, and as Streicher, the publisher of Der Sturm, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but a major anti-Semitic newspaper, mouthed the gallows. He shouted the word Purim Fest 1947.
What?
In German, not in English.
So, why would he scream that?
Why would he scream that?
How
because of this!
Yeah?
Because he ruined the Kurdish, right? Because this connection, 1947, 10 sons of Haman, 1947, the 10 Nazis, Purim, that was another kind of Purim.
So no one explains the reason why there isn't small before the notice? No payers tried to explain why there isn't small notice here?
Yes,
no, because it was the Jewish year, 5707.
No, he said before that. Before the Nazis were killed, what did people say about the little letters?
You're kind of saying this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, though.
I actually have to think this one's pretty cool.
Oh, okay.
I'm always tongue-in-cheek, but it is pretty cool.
So,
that's my point. This is like Q 101,
yeah.
Right? And if the Nazis went up to, you know, like, it was like,
yeah.
Sounds like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
If
the Nazis went up and got killed by the Golem, so then something like that should be recorded along with the Purim Fest 1947 story. That's why I tend to doubt that it's
correct.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see about that.
What's the
double dare.
What's the relevance of the small letters to the
Nazis? Because Tushin Zion corresponds to the year
1947.
I don't
know.
Well,
she be, no, it's 5707.
Yeah.
Tushin Zion is 707.
Tushin Samachet. That year would have been written Tushin Zion. 1947. Got it?
51
years
ago. Yeah. Alright, so Wikipedia says that the Golem is in the attic of the old new synagogue in Prague.
Yeah,
and Nazi saw it and died.
Said that there?
Yeah, Wikipedia.
I heard the
legend. Oh, legend told
that.
Is that
a picture of a gold?
Is that a gold
right
there?
Is there like a reference, like citation on it?
Oh, there's a ton of citations.
Good question.
Attic and old synagogue and Prague.
Any news sources?
No, I think the other way around. When was Frankenstein published? Early 1800s, if I remember correctly, right?
1938.
What? Frankenstein? What year?
Yeah, Mary Shelley, the old...
I think it's 1820s, 1830s.
It's 1946.
What?
The original Frankenstein?
That was after Rosh Hashanah.
No. The outburst that he made was 1946. So it's going for 1946.
That wouldn't work.
No, but they were hung after Rosh Hashanah.
After Rosh Hashanah?
He might have said it.
I looked it up, that's what he said.
Okay, so it has to have been, but after Rosh Hashanah, that's
I can check my sources.
Check Streicher on Wikipedia, see when
Julius Streicher last word, it's actually, I checked on Time, or whatever magazine. It looked like they took a picture of the actual magazine from that time and put it online, and that's
No, I know he said Purim Fest. I'm just going to question what year.
It could have been 46, but it was still after Shoshana.
Yeah,
the year
all
that is 57.
Yeah. No, I know. That's what we're looking up now.
Hoshana
Rabba?
There's also some criticism about that because there are other versions of the Megillah that don't have different letters. Small.
But not ours.
Well,
not any standard text nowadays.
Not the standard, but the one I think that's used by the Yemenite has different letters.
The Yemenites, they didn't undergo the Holocaust, so it wasn't relevant to them.
It's the same.
What year? What day was he killed? Hung?
Oh, yeah.
They made it like the month or the week after Rosh Hashanah.
707, which corresponds to the year 1947. Today, this is the year 768, right?
Why would it do that? The dating system was, you take the date plus 1240, isn't it?
What? Except at the end of the year, it doesn't work. From September on, approximately, when Rosh Hashanah takes place. So that's why if it was killed after Rosh Hashanah, it would have already been 5707. No? Doesn't say?
I'm looking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway,
cool,
I happen to think just that that's a cool. It happens to be a very cool. That's impressive. I was impressed by that one.
Is that like an Arachim type of thing?
Yeah, it's an Arachim type of thing. Okay. Yeah.
Wait, this is actually published.
Even though they use it, I think it's pretty cool.
Wait, is this published by anybody particular? The whole
forum, Josh. There's a Jewish Observer article about it. I don't know if it's I don't know who first came up with it. We can find out.
October 16th.
Okay, so it was after what's called? After Rosh Hashanah.
Discovery books
also. Okay. How many of you didn't know that? How many of you didn't know that before tonight?
What?
I did not.
Who didn't know the story of Purim Fest 1946?
I like Purim Fest.
Oh, not bad. Okay. So we actually learned something tonight. thank you. Good. So getting back to our topic, so the Maharal, he doesn't actually do stuff like that. But he does deal with numbers a lot. The Maharal held, and this is a very big story in the Maharal, more than many stories we're going to speak about, every number has significance. For example, twos are bad and threes are good. Why are twos bad? Because two is just two points. There's nothing unifying them. Three has a point which unifies. That's the point in the middle, which unifies the two signs. Six is a cube, because the cube has six sides. Seven includes the middle point of the cube, which transcends the cube and unites all the sides together, which is why the many significant sixes in Judaism, which are then united by the seventh thing, which is, for example, the days of the week, are 6 days plus Shabbos, which unites all of them.
But yeah. You would say it would be an actual middle point, or you're saying that the seventh is the whole?
The seventh, you could say it's the whole. I think he says the middle point, but I don't think he means, it's the exclusional. In other words, that which unifies them.
Okay.
So I have a Sefer at home which goes through all the numbers according to the Maharal, what their significance is. The ones the Maharal speaks about, of course. Not, he doesn't
really
know. So that's why Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, right? The six letters and the six words in that statement, and of course, it was recited by Klal Yisrael, that's the ultimate Yichud Hashem. You have also 600,000 people in Klal Yisrael, which are united by Torah. So the seventh is the six sides, and that which unites all of them together. Eight, then, transcends the cube altogether, right? The six is, the six are the six sides of the cube, plus the seven, which can unify them, or is the totality of the cube, and eight is transcendent. That is why everything eight transcends nature, right?
What is significant eight?
Shavuot, which goes, it's not really an eight, but it's after seven times seven, right? The 50.
Same concept,
yeah. So, I'm sure there are more eights, which I guess can't think of offhand. But you have the eighth sphere for the bottom up is Bina. That's, in other words, the first sphere is to transcend motion and regions of the intellect. As it says in Bnei Bina, you may Shmona Kavushir Renonim. I'm sure somebody spoke about that in Hanukkah, right?
No.
Right? Bnei Bina, you may Shmona Kavushir Renonim. Well, the song is not a Kabbalistic song. And although it doesn't seem that way, it seems to be some German church store. But that's just the tomb. The name Bina, because they were Mizbonim, which is the eighth meter from the bottom. In other words, when you start growing, you grow and grow and grow until you hit Bina, understanding. So they understood that this is miraculous. That's why they made 8 days instead of 7 days, to demonstrate that the miracle was not just on the last 7 days, it was also the first day was also part of the miracle. But that's going a little bit further afield. Nine is also has to do with a cube, but it's when you have I forget how he does it. The points. The cube has 8 points, right? So on a cube you have 6 sides and 8 points. So the 8 points are unified by the 9, and 10 again transcends the points. So now you have the cube is a lower level completion. Besides the cube, a lower level completion. That's the 6, 7, 8 series, and the points of the cube are higher level completion. That's the 8, 9, 10 series. You understand? You get that? Right? And the 12 is, of course, significant because it's 4 times 3. You have that 3 in all directions, right? And that's, in fact, the way Klal Yisrael was camped in the desert, right? 3 shvatim on each side of the Mishkan. That's the 12. And, of course, the 13 is that which unites them in the middle. And you can go on and on and on. There are many significant numbers. 40 is a good number. 50, 60, lots of good numbers in Judaism. Anyway, without getting further into that, I do want to get further than that. Sorry. That's why the Maharal says, when we have 300 in Chazal, which we had in the Agadah for learning Wednesday night, it doesn't mean the number 300. It usually is a metaphor for that which is incomplete. Because 300 represents, we said, Shin, because Gematria of 300 is Shin, and Shin is the penultimate letter of the Olivet, not the last letter, but the second to last letter. So 400, which is represents Tuf, represents something which is complete or has achieved perfection. 400 men, right. So the fight Yaakov, I didn't ever throw that before, but it's a good point. The fight Yaakov was called Ish Tum, a perfect person. You would have to have 400 soldiers. Very good. Okay.
Eliezer was 318.
Eliezer was 318, yeah. I'm not sure. That number is kind of strange, but I'm sure the Maharal could do for you that, I guess. Well, I see where you're going with that. The 300, which represents the bad kings, plus the 18, which is...
Oh, I heard they darted out that it was 318 men that fought during the battle.
No, but the 300 also, they were fighting bad guys, right? Yosef was fighting a good guy, right? So it needs 400 soldiers. Avraham Avinu was fighting a bad guy.
Oh.
So you only needed 300 plus the 18, I guess, was... Chai is always a good number. We have to come up with why it's relevant here, but yeah, we could do something with that. The Maharal says... the Maharal does words like also in a similar vein. For example, he says that the word Tom, which we just used to describe Yaakov Avinu, is the opposite of the word...
Mate.
Right. Because the opposite of death is perfection. Death is imperfection. The opposite of death is perfection. That's why Chazal say, among other reasons, Yaakov never died. Not because he literally never died, because he did die, but because in his spiritual accomplishment, he achieved perfection. Yaakov Ish Tam was a perfect person, and therefore it's as if he never died. That's why tzaddikim, when they are dead, are still considered tzaddikim, meaning we saw them through time. Even when they're dead, they're considered alive. Yeah.
That's how they said they would kill the golem. It had the MS written on its chest, and to whatever, make it be functional, you erase the Aleph of the MS and it becomes...
That's what it was. I thought it was because it had like the Shem Hashem. See, there are all sorts of versions of this book.
Okay.
I thought it's because it had the Shem Hashem or a name of Hashem written on a piece of paper, like an amulet was inside of it, and when the Maharal took it out, it expired.
Yeah.
What? That's your version?
It looks like a batter.
So, since the story is not true, whatever version works, you know.
Had the bowl in the forehead?
Why couldn't it be
true? What if what?
The bowl in the forehead.
The bowl?
Yeah, the bowl with the name on it, like a stone or something, and put in the forehead.
Yeah, okay, some idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is just connected to the things that the Sadiqim, like, they're still alive. Have you ever heard a source that they actually, like, mouth out the words? Like,
yeah, Gemara says that.
Yeah,
when you say something to the name, they mouthed out that in the kever.
What?
A thought is, you know, it's the neshama still always retains, even after death, a residual connection to the body. The way it works. It's just not a full connection. So that residual connection means that the neshama still derives some level of pain or pleasure, not physical plane of pleasure, but spiritual plane of pleasure from what happens to the body in this world. What? So if the body is speaking words of Torah, so that gives spiritual pleasure to the neshama.
What happens when the body is completely desecrated and you have nothing left?
When it's completely
disintegrated.
Yeah, so I guess they still have the bones. Yeah. But in any event, look, if it does, maybe it only takes place for a certain amount of time. I don't know exactly.
So when the body is, like,
rot?
Yeah, getting rotten, then does the neshama suffer?
Yes.
So
that's part of man's punishment for his sin, is the body rotting.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Where does it say that?
What?
Where does it say that?
Oh, all over the place. That's why the worm beat the flesh. All that good stuff. What?
The mouth of olives is the best burial place because there's some kind of thing in the soil which makes the body deteriorate quicker.
Yeah. By the way, that's the way they used to do it. The way they used to bury people is first they would leave them in stone coffins to decompose and only then bury them in the ground so they decompose quicker. I don't know why it's decomposing quicker, but that's what they used to do. Yeah.
The story of the Golem begins that there's a lot of attacks on the Jewish community. So what he did is he wrote on a piece of paper a question. And you put on the pillow or something like that. In the morning, he had the answer. Right. Is that like existing anywhere in Jewish sources?
Yes, but not about the Maharal. There is a truth. There's a Shiloh Tshuva Sefer written by one of the Bali Sefers. It's called Shilos Utruvos Min HaShemayim. And that's what he was supposed to have done. I forget his real name. Every day when he had a Shiloh, he put the slip of paper under his pillow, and in the morning he pulled it out, and he said an answer. Right, and that's what they say about the Sefer. We don't pass them like it because Lord HaShemayim.
What?
Right? Because the halacha can't be determined in heaven, it has to be determined on earth.
I heard the Sefer in Baal Shem Tov. So
he has
a book,
True of Baal Shem Tov. No, it's not Baal Shem Tov. It's one of the Rishonim.
No, I heard about Shem Tov.
Baal Shem Tov doesn't. He has no such sefer.
Something along the lines, when he asked the Shemayim, which is the correct version of Torah, and he says the other one is, not the Rashi, the Beit HaTam. The
Beit HaTam
is...
I don't think so. But, you know... perhaps I don't remember the fellow's name, the Shiloh Jewish Mish Mayim, but you know there are other people who are called Baal Shem besides the Baal Shem Tov. Anybody who's able to use names of Hashem or names of Malachim in order to work miracles is called the Baal Shem. So there are other Baal Shem, there's a famous Baal Shem of Michelstadt, about which there's a book written, and there are other people called Baal Shem because they were able to use names of God to do all sorts of miraculous stuff.
Yes, they didn't
do it.
Right? Yes, they didn't do it, right? I'm saying, like you said about the Boston W, you don't believe, you can't
believe everything.
Right.
You can believe some of it is true, but can't believe everything. By the way, there's a picture of the Baal Shem Tov, a drawing of the Baal Shem Tov. Anybody ever seen it?
Is
it in the Shrine Room? What? No, he's not actually. And it's not actually the Baal Shem Tov. It was the Baal Shem of London. London, England, who was kind of an eccentric character who eventually converted to Christianity. So, so it's not exactly a nice picture for the Baal Shem to be associated with. But commonly, if you ever see a picture of Baal Shem Tov, that's who was, the quacky, the quack Baal Shem Tov of London.
Baal Shem of London.
I got one in my room over me, like sitting in the forest.
He's what?
Like sitting in a forest.
No, that's just drawn. There's actually. a droid, looks like a chubby kind of that looking guy. Looks kind of weird.
Oh, yeah.
Look at Wikipedia. Well, yeah. Old couple is really skinny. What? Old couple is really skinny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
No.
So
only to the Lao Shenpa time. After Lao Shenpa, they didn't fast anymore.
What?
Because Lao Shenpa, when we get to Lao Shenpa, we'll talk about it. But Lao Shenpa said, well, his fasting is no good. He chucked all that fasting stuff.
He's a heater.
That's right.
But
that's
yes, in the Tanya, it says, if you fast 2 half days, it's considered like one meal fasting.
When they what?
If you fast 2 days until Chatzot, it's considered one day of fasting.
Okay, so that's also one line of abolishing fasting. Because they wanted to diminish the for the amount of fast, so they said, okay, fast fasting, not 4 days. I think it's only one of those lines. Anyway, to take the go for a little bit more in depth to my route, I want to give you an example of what he does with Haggadah. It's very interesting Haggadah above Messiah and above Asher, not the ones we're doing, although he speaks extensively about those too. But there is an Agatha which says that Rabbi Banor was one of the Amoraim, was going and he was marking graves. Literally he was marking caves in which burials took place. In order to know, Rashi says, or Rashbam says, in order to know where the Tumah was, so the Kohanim wouldn't go where they're not allowed to go. So it says when he came to the cave of Avraham Avinu, he found Eliezer, the servant of Avraham Avinu, standing in front of the door. And he asked Eliezer, what's Avraham doing? So he says, so Eliezer answered, he's sleeping in the embrace of Sarah, and she's looking at his head, which was, in those days, people who loved each other used to check each other for life. Looking at his head was a term of endearment or some sort. Rabbi Banoah told Eliezer, go tell Avraham Avinu, Banoah's at the door. Okay? he went to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu said, let him come in, because he knows that there's no Yetzirah in this world. So he went in, and he measured the cave, measured where the Shumah was, and he went from cave to cave. When he came to the cave of Adam Arishon, which is also there, a voice came out and said, you look at my image, meaning, I believe, Yaakov, because Yaakov is said to resemble Avraham Avinu. At me, myself, you can't look. So Rabbi Benoah said, but wait a minute, I want to check out how the measurements work out. So he says, so as Adam said, I'm translating more before. Hashem said, you look at the image of my image. At my image himself, because of that Adam said, so tell Elohim, that you can't look at. So the Baal said, like it is on top, that's what it is below, meaning I guess there was some structure on top, and he said, you follow that structure. And the Rav Noah said, nevertheless, I looked at the two heels of Adam Arishon, and they were like two orbs of the sun. And then the Gemara says, the beauty of Sarah was such that anybody in front of Sarah was like a donkey, was like a monkey. And in front of Sarah herself was like a monkey versus Chava, Eve. And Chava was like a monkey versus Adam. And Adam is like a monkey before the Shekhinah.
Wow.
Okay. So the
you guys are all so ugly.
A poor imitation.
Yeah.
Of course, so this is what the Maharal does with this. So the Maharal says, he said, Maharal writes about that. None of this is literal. He says that Rabbi Manoah gave a definition and distinction between rabbis after their death. Because during a person's lifetime, you can't define them because the definition can always shift. After you finish defining the guy, he can do something which will go either bring him like this or bring him like that. So therefore, definitions can only take place after death. So he says that, so that's why Rabbi Banoah went around after people's death to try and figure out what their precise level was. So, this is what he was doing. He came to Avraham Avinu and wanted to know what his definition was. How do you define Avraham Avinu? So it says he found Eliezer at the opening, and that Avraham was sleeping in Sarah's embrace, And all this shows of Avram's greatness, he says. Because since Avram had Eliezer as a slave, and there's no doubt that the slave is according to the master, right? And we know that Eliezer himself, he goes through a whole description over here, that how Eliezer himself was a special kind of person. And then, since he saw Eliezer, we know Eliezer is a special kind of person, therefore we know that that Avram himself was an even more special kind of person. And again, he didn't actually have to see Eliezer for this. He analyzed Eliezer based on what they knew about it, and from this he extrapolated and understood the Madrega of the Marisha. And of Adam, sorry.
Yeah, but you can look at just the same mice as Abraham to be able to gain character insight. Like, we have just as much information about more about Abraham, so why is it like, look at his servant?
Well, we have a whole parashat in Torah, Chayei Tzara, where it describes Eliezer in great, great, great detail,
yeah.
Right? Much more detail, actually, than we ever have about Abraham Avinu. So I assume they extrapolate from things like that to other Abraham. Yeah.
I know Adam is really close, the first man and all, but wasn't Abraham the better man? Why is he not as bright? And
because the body of Adam was created by God.
But
that's
I thought we
were
talking spiritual.
What?
I talking spiritual.
Well, he'll get there.
So, but wait, so is Adam's not spiritually as beautiful as...
Not necessarily, no.
But the body is.
Yeah. The body of a righteous person doesn't decompose. That's not always true, I shouldn't say.
So
some righteous people's bodies don't decompose. Adam's body didn't decompose, right? So even the physical aspect of Adam still retains that great that great and powerful radiance which Adam had.
You guys know in Yaakov with the buckets and buckets of fat, the liposuction they did?
About Rabbi Shimon, was it?
Yeah,
it was Rabbi Shimon. Yeah.
Well, without Adam, Abraham wouldn't have existed.
Right. That's true also, but I guess it's significant here that we skip from Avram to Adam.
Mm.
Meaning, Yitzchak Yaakov that I mentioned here, because we're sort of drawing the link between Adam, who, even though he had great potential described by these sons, did not fulfill his potential, and Avram Avinu, who came to complete that task.
So he was able to go to Yaakov and
Yitzchak,
but then he couldn't go to Avram.
No, he could go to Avram. He went to Avram,
Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He couldn't go because Eliezer was there.
Eliezer gave him permission, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before that,
I don't know if he went to Yitzchak and Yaakov first or second. It doesn't say here. I don't know how it works. Yeah.
In terms of like all the stories of Maharal and the Gaon of Vilna, how do we really know some of them are true? Because did they write their own biographies or did students wrote them? Because there's a whole story about LeBron, how his mother sort of was walking on the bank of a river and it was like rain and there's like a baby floating in the river.
Sounds like Moshe
Rabbeinu. Right, how are you supposed to know what's true or what's not? Like, if the golem is not true, how do I know really, you know, if the Baal Shem is really poor? It says he was.
Yeah, how would you know?
Right, how would I know?
So who cares?
He was rich. I mean, it's good to know they're great and awesome people, but a lot of the times we hear the great people from the stories. Well, I don't know if this is all like, he did a lot.
So that's why stories are not, that's the difference between, to a large extent between Magdalen and Hasidim, is that by Hasidim, stories are essential components of their relationship with the Tzaddik, and that relationship with God, by extension. Magdalen always, until recent times, Magdalen always looked down on that. And they said, you don't look at the stories, right? Look at who they were and what they wrote or what they did and what they said. So, excuse me. So therefore, you know, all these recent developments that people tell all sorts of wonder stories about non-Hasidic rabbis is a recent development. So you're right, about the Grah, these books, they relate to legends. Are the legends true? Probably not, but they don't tell those legends about other people. So we should tell them over. They're interesting to see. You understand what I'm saying?
But it's patently false. Wait, how can you say something that's patently false and then try to present it off as true? How is that ethical in any way?
It sells books. Who says it's true?
It's called power.
Who said they're presenting it as true?
They presented it as true. They say these, so they don't put any type of disclaimer before the beginning of any of these books that these things are not necessarily true. No whatsoever.
Look at Ms. Marshall's as how to convey their greatness.
I think it
wouldn't fail if they put these disclaimers.
But in Jesus, they were actually on it.
Who are we talking about? They don't put out books like that nowadays, for the most part. I shouldn't say that. But there are nowadays there are books which try and like they have recent biography of the girl which got a little upset because it told stuff as it was, and so that was very copiously researched. Everything is documented by from letters or from the earlier spine. So you have people who have made a serious attempt to try and peel back all the improper additions and gather the actual kernel of truth. But as I said. Really, what we can, you know, if you go to a non-orthodox rabbinical school, so there they're gonna tell you a lot in let's say college, they're gonna even where there are orthodox professors, they're gonna talk about a lot about Abaye and Rava, who they were and where they functioned and how Talmudic times, how the Jews functioned Talmudic times and various other things, and you go to yeshiva. And you have almost no clue about Rava, but there are people who appear in the Gemara all the time, right? Why? Because there's a difference. In other words, we're not focusing on the history of the thing, but on the thing itself. And that's also true about the Gemara. Now, there are certain shortcomings to that, because sometimes it's important to understand the person's approach to know the historical context of where that person lived and who he interacted with. So I'm not saying it's good this way, but... Because that's the idea. We focus on what they said, not on who they were.
I guess just like a background, even if the story's not sure, at least to give certain key points, like where he's from, what type of environment he lived in. It's not necessarily per se the story is true. It's giving you a background idea of what the circumstances were at the time.
Yeah, you got a flavor.
Okay.
You got a flavor. And, you know, there are certain stories which are, you know, there's the famous story about the Ger Tzedek. I don't remember the exact name, but the Graf Kotowski, I think that was his name, was one of the Polish counts who converted to Judaism, and he was killed at Kiddush Hashem, and he was buried next to the Grosh, and there was a tree which grew out of his grave, indicating his great tzidkus. So there's all sorry about the girl's relationship with him, what the girl told him, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if everything they say he told him true, but not necessarily, but there is that kever next to the girl's kever, and then we know that he was killed, and we know the tree grew, et cetera, et cetera. So there are sometimes things will be embellished, but there's a kernel of truth which we know inside it.
They're just modern midrashim. When you read midrashim, you say, oh, they're lying to midrashim. They convey something about their kever.
Yeah, but we think when midrashim written by Chazal, they have a deeper meaning. And these midrashim don't have a deeper meaning per se, they're just stories which make it more cool.
Well, like the Golem
which
story
is also
can
perfect.
Be a midrash here.
What?
Like the Golem story cannot really be a modern day midrash. It's more like a trek towards the buy t-shirt.
Okay. Right, no, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
In other words, it makes people more excited about the topic. There's no deeper message in it. Yeah.
So if you're something like the statement that every rabbi in the Gemara like has to have the ability to revive the dead. Does that mean that's literally, like, they could have met or did revive the dead, or is it, like, just, like, it would seem like, what's the problem believing that, because, I mean, if they understood Torah in the right way, then why couldn't they do that to the world? They could certainly do whatever they wanted, right?
Yeah, why couldn't the Manuel create
a Torah? Who says he did? Well, he could have, certainly could have.
No, I'm not saying about the...
Well, what do you mean? Why?
Because
I obviously, God doesn't want to create something.
No, because I'm saying that some rabbi, he said, like, it didn't mean like that. It doesn't mean like that. It means like a Ravad is dead. It's like they could bring people back to Jews. I mean, they're very powerful and they have such great minds. Like, you know, because like that's like Ravad is dead. It's kind of like, you know, up there. You know, it's like seems out of
okay.
Scope.
Okay, so German interpretation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why couldn't? But it could be that they also like if you were, like they said, a spike, I forget who someone killed.
Rava killed Rabbi Zera.
Right, and then he brought him back to life.
Yeah, Rabbi Yochanan also killed Rav Kahana, brought him back to life.
You understand that as. I mean, you could
no, I understand it being real.
Right. Like,
oh,
yeah.
Can't
he's dead on the ground, and
but,
he's like...
Right. But if it says all that to be Mikhail Mason, that is, this Rob is right, that's probably a metaphor.
How come
you
can't say that, like, you know, he made him poor and it gave him financial restitution after that?
Because
that
they
insulted
it
him.
It says this whole story about they brought him into the grave, and they brought him into the whole story. Can you say that? Yes, but it's a gut feeling I have that it's not like that.
Why did they kill him?
What?
Why did they
kill who?
Whoever they were killed.
Rabbi killed Rabbi Zera on Purim.
Yeah.
What?
And he was drunk.
So he's kind of Misa.
Yeah, but he brought back to life, so it's not brown.
But he killed someone.
That's just the Purim Megillah. It says Rava killed Rabbi Zeva, right? And at the Purim Sudah, and then he died and brought him back to life. So he shackled him.
You're still bench pressing
that? So, what? And then the next year, Rava again invited Rabbi Zeva to the
Purim Sudah,
and Rabbi Zeva said, not this year. So we don't allow the miracles to happen every year.
No reason.
Not coming back.
So
you should be doctors do that all the time. When you take a patient and put him in a heart lung machine, he is halachically dead.
That's interesting. Oh, but that makes it
less fun. Now allowed to walk into the room? No. Theoretically. Mice, he can, because since the neshama, we assume that neshama is still there because he can be brought back to life. But halachically, if you went to disconnect the machine now, it would be killing because he's already dead.
You say that the Shema and the Kabbalah is still hanging out there because it knows its potential for it to come back to life.
Well, the blood is still pumping.
But if we have a halakhic definition of when death is, shouldn't
the Shema
follow
definition
it?
Of death is when the heart ceases pumping blood.
Okay.
Which is the heart can cease pumping blood.
So at that point, then from
the
Shema, it's beginning
what?
Exit.
Breathing because it's a sign of the heart working. Yeah. No,
so
it's a sign. It's clear from the Gaon of Vilna that that's the case. And they stop at the same time, the breathing of the pumping of the blood. So,
if the brain stops, if the heart's still going, then it's like.
That's the whole question of halacha. Whether the brain stops and the heart's still going, is that considered to be death? Most of them will not.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're like a tortured soul.
What?
Tortured like Neshama is just
kind of. I assume pessimistic expects that the body is going to be brought back to life because the doctors should know what they're doing. Yeah. Okay, everybody tight. Have a good night. We'll see you tomorrow next Wednesday.
Hey, Yossi. I love you. Have a good night.
This isn't Yossi's property, Cody.
Oh.
Yeah.
I
is
it?